KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
You're tuned in to KAEB, 91.9 on your FM dials, playing you the hits from yesteryear, this year, and the next.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, March 3rd, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uriel.
And this week we're going to be talking about Colorado's state fish, the greenback cutthroat trout.
We've got two great guests joining us for this episode. Josh Homer is the hatchery manager at our Leadville National Fish Hatchery in Colorado. And Chris Kennedy is a fish biologist at our Colorado Fish and Wildlife Conservation Office. And I really love it when we can get kind of both arms of our fisheries and aquatic conservation program together. So very warm welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
First things first, what does this fish look like? And does it have any features that really stand out or that are helpful with identifying it, maybe compared to some other trout people might be familiar with?
It's a very beautiful cutthroat trout. Has some very distinct spotting, typically on the tail, along the back, nice brown spots. The body's kind of more of a golden brown than a green, but it does tend to green a lot of times. Very robust fish. It typically grows very short with a wide, round body. Right up underneath the gill plates, there'll be some pretty distinctive red slashes. As far as identifying it in the wild, if it were mixed in with other cutthroats, it could be pretty difficult to tell. We're more looking at its actual location. But yeah, very, very beautiful fish, very photogenic towards a spawning season. The males especially will get a very red belly a lot of times.
All right. And so you mentioned there that, you know, it can be hard to distinguish these fish just by looking at it. If you had a pile of cutthroat trout that came from different drainages, trying to sort that out would be a mess. But if you do know the drainage you're in, you can probably tell what these fish are. So where can you find these fish? Historically, where could you have found them and where can you find them today?
Historically, these fish were just in the South Platte drainage. That's what most of the research has shown us. Nowadays, though, they've been pretty well extirpated from just about all of their native range, and we're only putting them into just a handful of small high mountain creeks and a few lakes. These are the lakes and creeks, and they had all their other fish removed, so they're fishless when we bring these fish in there, and they're also barriered because we don't want the chance of outside genetics making their way up into these creeks. So right now, they're only located in just a handful of waters. The main one that people can catch these fish in is the Joe Wright Reservoir. We put all of our retired brood stock in there. And it's a small reservoir up above Walden, Colorado. Each year we put somewhere around 250 to 300 fish back into that lake, and a handful are caught each year up there.
Is this the easternmost of the cutthroats? I'm trying to get a picture kind of in my mind. If we were going to look at like cutthroats in general, what's the overall picture that we kind of see?
They are the easternmost. We also have some Rio Grande cutthroat that are south of the historic range of greenbacks. They're also kind of on the eastern edge of the historic range of cutthroat.
So these guys are an Oncorhynchus. That's the Pacific trout and salmon, generally speaking. How did these fish get over to the eastern side of the Continental Divide?
It's just presumed. You know, they were historically present in the Pacific Ocean. At that time, when they started moving inland, there was periods of glacial activity. The current drainages were not set up as they are now. So it's believed that they were able to move their way in to what's now Colorado. And over time, as the glaciers receded and the drainages formed, they got isolated. And so each of these different subspecies of cutthroat trout, you know, were isolated from each other, and they speciated out a little bit, or, you know, mutated to what they are now.
The Rocky Mountains, that's a pretty new range. Was it before that kind of cropped up that these fish were able to get over? Or was there some sort of, like, when you're talking about it being glaciated, some sort of water body that went across the barrier? So how did these guys
get? Yeah, maybe, you know, there was ice formations and water spilled out over a divide. Some of the explanation that I've heard that maybe it did happen after the Rocky Mountains were formed, but they just got over in areas that had low passes and then got into new areas.
Yeah, we're talking about kind of where they are on the map, but from a habitat standpoint, what are their preferences? Where can you find them, like in a stream? What kind of habitat do they like? What do they need to live?
They typically like the high mountain streams, very clear, cold water. That's about the only place you can find them now. Historically, they were farther down in the watersheds as it is now, whether it's climate change or just the overall habitat that's available. They're mostly found just in headwater lakes and creeks, very small water bodies a lot of times, sometimes water that are only just a couple of feet wide, a few inches deep, are some of their prime habitats now and where they're currently found.
Yeah. What kind of elevation are we talking about? You guys are pretty high.
You're up in Leadville.
Yeah, I was going to say. You guys are like 10,000 feet or something?
Yeah.
What was that? What's the elevation?
Yeah, Hatchery's 9,800.
A lot of the populations that are left of Greenback are restoration populations, and those have to be above some kind of fish migration barrier. That's to exclude non-native fish. We have to put these into headwater areas, so a lot of them are over 10,000 feet.
I'm glad you described some of this habitat, because you mentioned them being into the South Platte River specifically. When I think of the Platte River, I'm used to driving along 80 through Nebraska, through Kearney and stuff. I'm like, that's not trout habitat at all. That's low-grade, silted, braided type stuff. You've mentioned already throughout the show that the restorative population, so I assume that it's not doing well. Is that the case? How's it doing? And if it's not doing well, what led to that?
Yeah, so right now it's federally threatened, but there's only one self-sustaining population in existence. The history of the greenback is truly like a roller coaster. As Josh said, they're historically present in the South Platte River drainage. In the 1930s, the greenback was thought to be extinct. And this was due to over-harvesting. You know, in the 1800s, we had a lot of mining activity, and those miners had to feed on something. So there's plenty of stories of them going fishing with dynamite and get some greenbacks. But the big thing that caused their decline was introduction of non-native species. We know that when these cutthroat trout are in streams with fall spawning fish like brook trout or brown trout, they'll displace the cutthroats over time. All these other taxa of cutthroat trout as well as rainbow trout can hybridize with them. That led to the decline. Over time, there were a few populations that were discovered like in the 1960s or so. And based on those populations, recovery efforts started in the early 1970s when the Endangered Species Act was enacted. Greenback were one of the first species that went on there. They went on as endangered. Through the 1970s, there were some successful recovery efforts, and then it was downlisted to threatened in the late 1970s, and then recovery efforts continued through the 1990s, and again, they were successful, and it got to be the point in the late 1990s when I started my career with greenbacks that they were talking about delisting. They were getting close to the goals that were set out in the recovery plan. And so, you know, kind of up at the high, I was talking about the roller coaster. So we get into the 2000s, you know, genetic techniques are becoming better and being able to differentiate between these cutthroat trout taxa. We got involved with geneticists from the University of Colorado Boulder. And they did two studies that really had very significant consequences to greenback recovery and taxonomy of cutthroat trout in Colorado. The first study, they were given tissue samples from several populations, which were presumed to be greenback cutthroat trout east of the Continental Divide and Colorado River cutthroat trout west of the Continental Divide, which is another subspecies. When they ran their genetics, they did find that these two groups of populations differentiated out, but they didn't differentiate out like what we previously thought they were. There were some populations that were considered greenback cutthroat trout that actually fell into this Colorado River cutthroat trout group. And that had significant consequences for the greenback recovery because two of those populations were considered the purest of the pure greenback. And they were part of a captive brood stock that was used to stock into these restoration projects. So that kind of threw the whole greenback recovery upside down. So they did a second study. They used museum specimens of cutthroat trout that were collected in the 1800s. That was before widespread stocking in Colorado. And presumably those fish represent the genetic makeup of the cutthroat trout in the area that they were collected in. And so then they compared those to current populations, and they found that each major Colorado drainage had its own distinct cutthroat trout lineage. The vast majority of fish in Colorado were of two different lineages, and they were both from the western side of the state, not within the South Platte drainage. And so what was being recovered as greenback cutthroat trout was not greenback cutthroat trout. It was fish that were native to these two western drainages. Another significant finding was that there was only one population of greenback cutthroat trout left in existence. So we went from talking of delisting the subspecies to starting a whole new recovery effort based on this one population. So again, roller coaster, now we're down at the bottom. And so we're kind of starting new. 2008, they took some of those fish out of that population. They brought them into the hatchery system to replicate them in case something happened to that one population. And then also start a captive brood stock for recovery efforts.
Josh, okay. I assume that's where Leadville comes in to play. Can you kind of walk us through what you do there?
Well, yeah, here at Leadville, we have the only captive brood stock of the greenback cutthroat trout in existence. Like Chris said, we do have one wild population that's still breeding, still in existence. But with the years of work that we've done in the hatchery, we actually have the most genetic diversity in the hatchery as anywhere. So we're trying to maintain that, trying to keep that up. We have five different year classes of cutthroat trout here. We typically start them out as just eggs and fry and then grow them up. And we usually spawn them as 3-year-olds for their first year, and then we'll spawn them as 4- and 5-year-olds. This is a little different than a lot of other fish species that are held as broodstock. Some are very, very long spawners where you can get many years of spawn activity out, many years of eggs and good quality eggs. Whereas ours, we've determined that after year 5, they really start to go downhill. So that's why we retire them at that point and stock them out to other locations. We're only a small part of the overall program, though, even though we do have all of the broodstock here and we do all of the fish production. Most of the actual recovery activities take place at Mount Shavano State Fish Hatchery down in Salida. So they actually come up. We spawn the eggs starting in late May, and we'll continue spawning through early July. And all those eggs will get transferred down to Mount Shavano, except for the eggs we need to keep for brood recovery for future years, future brood.
How many brood fish do you keep on hand, and how do you go about selecting what you breed with what? I know with some highly endangered fish, like, you know, we talked about Delta smelt a couple seasons ago, they have unique genetic identifiers for each individual, and they figure out how do we maintain the best diversity. How do you guys go about that?
Yeah, good question. So it's really varied throughout the years. Like Chris said, it's been 2008 since we brought these fish in first, and we've been through a couple of different iterations. We started with a very robust genetic matrixing program where all of the individuals were genetically determined for overall parental genetics. And then we had a very robust cross of those fish, trying to increase the overall quality of the broodstock, the overall quality of the fish we're putting out into the wild. And after 3 years of this, we didn't really see any benefit. They were showing about the same amount of survival, the same growth rates, same die-offs as we were seeing before the genetic matrixing occurred. So after that, we went back to just a random one-on-one spawn. So we'll just take a random female and a random male, typically of different age classes, cross them together. And in any given year, we'll spawn up to around 1,000 different pairs of fish, trying to create as robust of a genetic cross as possible, trying to take advantage of the fact that we do have the most genetic diversity anywhere in the world existing in this hatchery. So we're trying to make sure we have a very, very robust genetic cross that will basically create the best fish hopefully in the future, but they're a very delicate fish. As a lot of people like to say, they try everything they can possibly do to die. It takes a lot of effort to make these things survive. And these fish are very sensitive. They're very sensitive to the environment they're in. Their genetics are making them more sensitive to issues that don't allow them to persist as well as a lot of these other species. Anybody that knows hatcheries and knows trout or salmon in general, a lot of those populations survive at levels anywhere from 80 to 95 plus percent from egg to a swim up fry or even a smolt. Our guys here, the greenback cutthroat trout, as an example, they're only surviving at a long-term average of 7%. We've had years as low as 0.07%, and we've been up around 15 to 20%. But for the most part, they're not surviving very well, and we're spending a lot of time and effort to improve that overall long-term survival. But it's a lot of effort on our part. We've got a very small hatchery, and we're picking millions of eggs per year when these guys die. So we're hoping to increase their overall long-term survival because that's just less work on us.
You have 2,000 fish, 1,000 male, 1,000 female. Are you getting multiple pairings out of the individuals, or how does that work?
So yeah, we do have a very good population of fish here. Currently, we're sitting on around 3,500 to 4,000 fish of all different age classes. And like I said, we typically keep 5 age classes here and spawn the oldest 3 age classes. In any given year, we'll spawn about 1,000 of those. Some don't spawn as the earliest age class. We typically only get about 30 to 60% of those fish to spawn. Our second age class, so age 4s, we'll typically get 100% spawn. And then our oldest age class, we'll still get about 100% spawn on those, but the quality has really gone down with that oldest age class. I told you earlier that we'll start spawning late May, and that'll go through early July. Some years it's a little bit later, some years it's a little bit earlier, but typically we peak around the middle of May. We basically just take that best middle spawning group, and then those are the eggs that go to be future brood and go for the recovery programs around the state.
Are there any protections in place for the hatchery or the water, or just like your operations to make sure that there's no chance of failure?
We are the second oldest national fish hatchery in the system still. We were originally constructed in 1889, and the fish are actually held in the original hatchery building. We have upgraded the plumbing since then. That's not perfect, but we've got a number of different alarm systems and water supplies available for these fish. So it's a pretty well-protected system. We actually have 3 different alarm systems that are operating at any one given time. We have one that's fully wireless electronic, and then we have one that's a wired electronic, and then we have one that's a total analog system. So occasionally people will be walking around our hatchery out here and an air raid siren will go off, and that tells us that we have a low water event for some reason or another. So we rush to the hatchery and try to figure out what the issue is. Beyond just our water systems and alarm systems, we do have oxygen backup systems. So if we were to lose water flow in the hatchery for whatever reason, and we weren't able to get it going again for a length of time, we do have an oxygenation system set up in each one of the raceways to keep these fish alive.
Chris, back to your point about non-native fishes. How are those non-native fish, like rainbow trout, for example, how do they outcompete them?
So typically in a stream, the largest fish are going to be in the best habitat. And then conversely, the smallest fish are going to be in the worst habitat. So these fall spawners, they start their reproductive process in the fall. They put their eggs down. They develop a little bit. They kind of go into a torpor over the winter, and then they commence developing in the spring. Well, these cutthroat trout are spring spawners, so they have like this developmental delay. The brown and the brook trout will emerge earlier than the cutthroat trout. So the young of the year of the brown and the brook are going to be larger than the cutthroat trout, so they're going to have better feeding positions. Since we're such high elevation, some of the places are temperature limited. So those young cutthroat trout fry don't get big enough to get enough fat reserves to survive that first year. That's kind of the thought process. But whatever happens in the winter, when the streams are covered, so nobody's actually directly researched that, or maybe they're just being fed on over the winter, but just over time, you know, they displace them.
That makes sense when you say it. The thing that's always sort of messed with my head a little bit is, if there's this advantage to spawning in the fall, why did cutthroat not evolve to spawn in the fall. There seems like there would have to be an advantage to spawning in the spring if you're going to continue to do it for millions of years.
Yeah, so like Josh said, historically, they were a lot lower in the drainage. They were in warmer areas. They were the only trout within the stream, so they didn't have to like battle against these non-natives. The habitat that they were in at lower elevations in Colorado, that was the best, you know, adaptive method for that. But now that they're on headwater areas that are temperature limited, we get into this situation where it might not be warm enough for long enough, because everything is temperature dependent. The timing of spawning, the development of the eggs that are in the gravel, and then once those fish emerge, the abundance of food. Through research, we know that cutthroat trout fry need to get to be about 30 millimeters before the onset of winter. They'll have enough fat reserves to survive in these headwater areas when they get to about 30 millimeters.
How does the public perceive these cutthroat? Do they know much about them?
Yeah, we have a fairly good marketing campaign within the state between Trout Unlimited and some of our other partners. And this is the state fish of Colorado. It's still only on the threat list, so we have some flexibility as far as these fish being able to be caught versus a lot of other threatened and endangered species that kind of shut down an area or make it so you can't fish an area. Or if you do catch something, it's against the law. Whereas these fish, they can still be caught. It's catch and release only, but they can still be caught. So there's a lot of support from the angling community, like I said, TU, Western Native Trout Initiative, a number of other organizations have a lot of support for this species, and Colorado Parks and Wildlife as well. They really tout the species. As far as hatcheries go, we're pretty well patriated. We get about 50,000 visitors per year here. And so we have a lot of the interpretive signage, a lot of information on the greenback cutthroat trout. They're pretty well thought of.
There is a lot of support in the state for recovery efforts, and have a lot of people, you know, contacting us. They're like birders. They have like their life list of all they want to, you know, catch every fish imaginable. So they want to know where they can go. Even though it's currently threatened, you can go and catch a greenback. It's definitely beneficial. People don't care about what they don't know about.
Real quick, what are the other cutthroat in the state? We've kind of mentioned some of these other subspecies, but outlining them, what are they? Also, wrap yellowfin into that question.
So we're kind of in a potential transition period as far as like cutthroat trout taxonomy, and it's partially based on, you know, some of the studies that I already previously said. When I first started out, everything west of Continental Divide in Colorado was Colorado River cutthroat trout. We had greenback cutthroat trout, which were native to the South Platte, and at that time, also the Arkansas River drainage. And then they had this yellowfin that was, at that time, it was considered a separate subspecies, and it was only found in Twin Lakes, which is just south of Leadville. Supposedly, it coexisted in the lake with greenbacks. And then in the Rio Grande drainage, we had the Rio Grande cutthroat trout. As I mentioned before, these studies kind of broke that up. Each major drainage in Colorado had its own genetic lineage. So within the Colorado, now within the Colorado River cutthroat trout, we have a green lineage Colorado River cutthroat trout that's native to the White River drainage and Green River drainage. We have a green lineage Colorado River cutthroat trout, which is native to the Gunnison and Colorado River and the Dolores. And then there's a San Juan lineage of Colorado River cutthroat trout. The yellowfin is now considered native to the Arkansas River drainage, but there are no current populations of that left in existence. And then the greenback is native to the South Platte. We're breaking it down, going from subspecies down to lineages now. Okay. Does that answer your question?
I know more now than I did when I asked the question, although I can't say that I have a complete confidence if I were to take a test in it that I'd be able to sort out all the Western cutthroat.
Yeah, and there's a new thing going on that they're trying to lump them back together. And
I've heard a little bit about that, yeah.
And so lumping and splitting going on, it seems like, in the fish world these days.
The stretch of stream that has a native genetically pure greenback, is that a trib to the South Platte or a trib to the Arkansas?
It's actually outside of its native range.
Oh, okay.
It's in a tributary on the side of Pikes Peak, which is kind of a famous mountain out here. And actually, the woman that wrote America the Beautiful was on top of that mountain when she got inspired. It's a small stream that comes off the eastern side of Pike's Peak. And I also consider myself a fish historian. So I've kind of researched that population and how it came to be there. The city of Colorado Springs is kind of at the base of the mountain. And people from the city wanted to go to the top of Pike's Peak. And the most direct route is up this Bear Creek where the fish are. They didn't have a road up there at the time. There is a road now. But it was a two-day hike to get up to the top of the mountain. There was a guy that homesteaded up there right along the creek. He was going to build a hotel and cater to these people and, you know, put them up overnight. In 1888, there was a guy up there that he was visiting, and he wrote a book on his travels in Colorado. And he said at that time that he was talking to this homesteader, but then he had to leave to go and clean rocks out of his fish pond. We know that area was historically fishless. So by 1888, we know that there were fish in there. Where did he get those fish? Just north of there is the divide between the Arkansas and South Platte River drainage. In the South Platte River drainage, we know that there was native fish there. We know that there was a fish hatchery there operating at that time in 1888. So it's most likely he either went up into that area because there was no trout in the Colorado Springs area and got those fish himself, or he got fish from that fish hatchery and then brought them into the stream.
It kind of reminds me of the Lahontan cutthroat trout from Pyramid Lake, that strain that got saved by being transplanted for someone wanting fish in their stream. I like the fish history.
What would recovery look like? What do people want to see happen with this fish into the future? What would be the ideal kind of scenario playing out?
We're due for a revamp of the recovery plan. We do have very low survival at the hatchery, and there are new populations out there that are relatively new, including this Bear Creek. We have 9 populations out there. We only see minimal recruitment in a couple of them, so we definitely need to improve the genetics and improve the survival, and then we need to create additional populations that are genetically separated and just more quality populations. We're not the only ones working on this. Josh mentioned Colorado Parks and Wildlife are huge cooperators. The Forest Service, a lot of these populations are on Forest Service lands. National Park Service, Rocky Mountain National Park, Bureau of Land Management, and then Trout Unlimited is a huge cooperator.
Yeah. From my perspective, I'd love to see these fish out of the hatchery one of these days and just have a few in my display pond out here. But as things stand now, it's a long road ahead of us to get these fish recovered. Making headway, but we have a long way to go.
Kind of along these lines of thinking about what recovery might look like, what is the value in having these native fish and this natural diversity out there on the landscape?
From a public value standpoint, as Chris mentioned earlier, there's a lot of support for being able to catch these fish. People have their list of all the different native trout across the United States. So there's a lot of support from fishermen. Then beyond fishermen, when you've got just the general public, they like knowing that there's native species out there. They like knowing that there are these fish out there still that were there back in the 1800s. Looking farther beyond the popularity of these fish, they tell us a lot about the overall quality of the water in these areas and just the overall health of the population, or the health of the ecosystem in general. And with the future being somewhat opaque as far as change goes, this is a species that could really start to fill a niche in these higher elevation stream sections. Anecdotally, they're very good eating. They were overfished for a reason. So if these things were recovered, they'd probably be a very popular food fish.
They're just part of a healthy functioning ecosystem. They involved in these ecosystems out here in Colorado. Maybe we can't get back to those, but we can certainly try. Josh mentioned them being bioindicators. You know, they need cool, clear, good water. There was a project I worked on in the early 2000s in Rocky Mountain National Park. They were looking at airborne contaminants coming down in National Park Service areas all throughout the West and up into Alaska. And they did find in Rocky Mountain National Park some fish that were intersex. It's pristine habitats, but they did find female sex cells within the male gonads in some of these high elevation lakes within the park, which is an indication that they were exposed to some kind of endocrine disrupting compound that somehow made it in there.
I think it's a pretty easy case to make that it's good to have cutthroat trout in these streams. Like you mentioned, they're good to eat. People love seeing these things. I am curious if at maybe the trough of that roller coaster you're talking about, where we realize, oh, these fish that we thought were the greenback subspecies were actually the Colorado subspecies. Did you receive any blowback from the public? Even the professionals can't tell the difference, and they're serving a very similar ecological role. What's the value in conserving this very particular subspecies that's even now occupying habitat that's different than it did historically?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely got blowback after the first study came out from University of Colorado Boulder. It hit the news outlets. When I give presentations, I have a collage of it. It's greenbacks, red faces. So much for trusting the expert. It actually even made it to the United Kingdom. There was a satirical newspaper there that had a picture of greenback cutthroat trout fish and chips. We got hammered pretty hard. These taxa are closely related, but they are the native fish. They were here before us. Our actions are the reason for their decline. We should feel a little guilty, I guess. It should not let them go extinct.
I guess I want to make a point, you know, as we're talking about the importance of conserving the amazing diversity of native fish we have in our country, right, including the greenback cutthroat trout. Knowledge is always progressing. It should be accounting for new advancements. You know, we're learning more about genomes. We're refining techniques. It's really an iterative process that doesn't just end, right? And that's, I guess, an expectation that we should be aware of and familiar with as a public when it comes to, you know, talking about conservation and recovery of fish like this. So very cool work.
It might be worth citing real quick. So we're recording this just after, in, I guess, in history terms, the snail darter. There's a paper that says, okay, new evidence suggests that the snail darter is really just a population of the stargazing darter, this fish that famously or infamously, however you want to look at it, brought the ESA, challenged that, but before the Supreme Court, actually isn't even its own species. One of the lead authors on that, Tom Neer, had a good quote. What he said was, the bottom line here is that we want the science used in defense of conservation to be good science. And I think that that's true. And so as things change, you have to adapt with the new findings and not just get stuck with, oh, this is what we've said historically. And when you're wrong, you know, admit that things have changed.
Yeah, science itself is very rarely ever settled science. There's always something new to learn, especially as technologies increase. We're always able to learn something new and just pick up a new nuance, new indicators that we weren't able to pick up just 10 years ago. Computers have changed these things so much. One of the analogies I like is with archaeology. Archaeologists used to take and they would destroy everything, basically, in their search for the truth behind their archaeological expeditions and excavations. And as things have evolved, they've learned that they don't have the ability to know everything right now. So they're basically just scratching the surface in a lot of these places and then covering things back up, leaving things in situ, which we can't do with an animal, but it's a good learning lesson. They've learned that when they destroyed these excavations, that they were never able to learn anything new on them. So by taking covering these up and waiting until the science is better than it was before, they can maybe go on and learn new things. That's one of the issues I think people have, is that they don't understand that they hear the science, they expect science to be set of data, whatever, but they don't realize it changes. And then all of a sudden it does change on them. They're just throw their arms up and it's like, oh, we can't believe anything anymore.
It's almost never we've learned it and it's done.
Yeah. To like the genetics, everybody wants everything like within this thing. Like, I mean, genetics is progressive. Things are speciating, they're changing. This genetic profile is a greenback cutthroat trout, but it is a progression. Within that greenback cutthroat trout, there are different lineages. There's different haplotypes within that. So each of those little groups are different genetically, but you want this like cookie cutter. This is a greenback. Genetics is constantly changing. It probably took, you know, hundreds of thousands of years for a Colorado River cutthroat trout to speciate out to a greenback after they got over the divide and got isolated. So what we're dealing with now is just a minuscule fraction of time genetic-wise, but it's not cut and dry.
Everybody no cookie cutter greenbacks for you. Yeah. And that diversity is important for resilient serotonin. There's a reason they got through those mutations.
I mean, we can't see the genetic code, but it's like a natural formation or a work of art. It's just something that's cool that exists.
I'm working on a species status assessment for the greenback, and it's like, how do you describe a greenback? I mean, is it in the appendices we're going to put the entire genetic code of it? Or usually you just describe it, it's the fish that was native to this drainage. You know,
thought that you guys were going to get softballs coming on the Fish of the Week podcast. Didn't expect to enter this viper's den.
Yeah.
I didn't expect the conversation to necessarily go this way, but I think it's a good conversation.
You know, the initial greenback recovery, I mean, they went with the best available science that they had. How they differentiated between different taxa of cutthroat trout is usually they used meristic characters. They used physical features on the fish. They counted scales. They looked at basibranchial teeth, pyloric ceca, which are in the digestive system. And that's what they had. And so they went on that best available science at that point. But as, you know, science developed and we have these new genetic techniques, and there's a whole other component there, because actually the type specimens for greenback cutthroat trout are probably based on genetic information and historical information. They may have actually been collected within the Rio Grande drainage.
Mm.
Getting back to the fish history stuff, the type specimens that were shipped to the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences came from Fort Riley, Kansas. So historically, trout were not out that far. What happened is there was a doctor associated with the Army. He was kind of a taxonomist, and he was associated with this Philadelphia Academy of Sciences. And he would collect specimens for the museum. When the soldiers went out, or he went out, he just collected specimens. Then they brought him back to Fort Riley, Kansas. So we don't really know where they were collected from. The tag on the specimens say Fort Riley.
Did it take a GPS mark or anything?
No, they didn't.
It was probably pre-GPS.
I know, I'm joking. Yeah. I'm totally joking.
A few years anyway.
Yeah, unfortunately, this doctor made something of himself. He became the Surgeon General for Abraham Lincoln. So he kind of was kind of...
Man, you really are a fish historian.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, there's information in books out there, you know, so it's kind of just trying to piece everything together.
Yeah.
That's a whole part of the process. You know, you got the science, but the history also can add to it.
Yeah, and it's over many years, many people collecting data and that best available information that changes through time. And I don't think that's a ding on the scientific process or scientists. It's just a natural progression of knowledge where we're constantly improving what we know. I am curious, from a fish and wildlife standpoint, we've got a hatchery representative, we've got a fish and wildlife field office representative. How do you guys typically work together in Colorado and more broadly the U.S.? Could you just give us a little insight?
So yeah, our fish and wildlife conservation offices and our hatcheries, they work very closely together. Our conservation offices are the ones that carry on the recovery science or the research science, whereas in hatcheries, we're propagating fish for whatever reason, whether it's mitigation, recovery, put and take, the tribal trust. Hatcheries have a very defined task, whereas the conservation offices, they're able to more broadly help out the hatcheries as well as the rest of the environment that we might be putting these fish in. So we work closely together. And in Chris's case, he's been my spawning coordinator here for a good number of years. So he's got the expertise on the species as it is in the wild, the recovery, and obviously the history.
We have to work hand in hand. I go up there to the hatchery, and then Josh and hatchery employees come out and help doing field work. It's a necessity that we work together. I guess I'd like to speak about the dedication out here of everybody. We're working hard on it. Right now, we've got 3 meta populations that are being created, which is a tremendous amount of work. It's like several streams that are kind of interconnected that can kind of exchange genetic material. And then also, if there's multiple streams, it also can be a buffer in case of flooding or a wildfire. If one of those stochastic events wipes out one of the streams, it can get repopulated from another stream. So these meta populations have a higher chance of long-term persistence.
Awesome.
But some of these projects are going to take 10 to 15 years to complete.
I'm curious how both of you came to work with this fish.
I first visited this hatchery sometime around 1985 with my grandmother, who lived just down the road. And I remember visiting the hatchery, the show pond that was out there, and I was very intrigued by the albino cutthroat that were raised in there. We've since got rid of those albino cutthroat, but we actually have a couple of them taxidermied on the wall still. They very well could have been the fish that were in that pond when I was a kid. It's just, it's amazing that I remember this specific hatchery that long ago. And now through a very long, convoluted trail, I've made my way back here again.
Super cool. Hatcheries are really neat to go visit. Chris, how about you?
My whole Fish and Wildlife Service career has been in this position, working with this fish. I moved to Colorado in the late 1990s. I met up with the former project leader for my office, who was kind of a titan in the early recovery efforts. Then I started volunteering for the office. And then, you know, he's, hey, Chris, do you want to do field work in Rocky Mountain National Park? I'm like, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
I suppose. And so my whole career has been working with this subspecies as well as other subspecies like cutthroat trout. I'll, you know, go out in the end, whenever that is, still working with greenbacks.
Right on. Awesome. Working on greenbacks, working for greenbacks. That's how you do it.
Yeah, we got the right guest for the show. That's awesome. Well, you guys have a wealth of knowledge, so thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
It was great. Thank you guys both for the great work that you guys are doing out there.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, we'll get out there and live from, discover and enjoy all the fish, especially native trout, like the greenback cutthroat trout. And go check out the Leadville National Fish Hatchery. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Arrow. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. There's nearly a 50-50 chance that the Alaska Permanent Fund won't have enough spendable money to pay dividends and the state's bills at least once over the next decade. That is, unless lawmakers change the structure of the fund to function more like a university endowment. That's the key takeaway from a presentation permanent fund leaders and the legislature's chief budget analyst gave to lawmakers last week. Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Devin Mitchell told lawmakers on Tuesday that the issue is not with the $80-plus billion permanent fund itself. Mitchell says the problem is with the fund's two-account structure.
We want to ensure that there's an ability to provide a payment to the state of Alaska each and every year. We don't want to have a 46% probability of failure. We don't want to have any probability of failure for this revenue stream at this point.
The permanent fund is separated into two accounts. There's the nearly $60 billion so-called principal, which can't be spent without a vote of the people. And then there's the so-called earnings reserve account, which has about $9 billion in spendable money. Legislators could spend every last dollar of that by a simple majority vote. Now, lawmakers are considering a constitutional amendment that would combine the two accounts into one. Legislative budget analysts say that would solve the problem. The amendment would also constitutionally cap the draw at 5%, creating what the Permanent Fund's board chair describes as, quote, predictability and sustainability for the fund going forward. Two men are missing and presumed dead after an all-terrain vehicle went through the ice Thursday on a river in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Tess Williams says five people were on the side-by-side ATV that went into the Susitna River just before 9 a.m. Thursday. The group was doing work for Alaska Directional Drilling and another contractor.
Three of those people were able to get out of the water, but two were reported to have gone under the ice in the current.
The survivors walked to a nearby work camp where they were picked up by a chartered helicopter. None required medical attention. The accident comes during an unseasonably warm winter in Alaska, which has affected everything from the state's wildfire season to traditional sports like the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. Williams says Thursday's incident carries important safety messages for Alaskans.
snow and ice conditions around Alaska and South Central right now are definitely not great. The ice is just not a safe place to be. It's important for people to check conditions, thickness, and things like that before you go out on the ice.
Troopers identified the two men who went under the ice as 42-year-old Sean Kendall of Anchorage and 32-year-old Sky Wrench from Wasilla. Troopers say they've transitioned to a reactive search effort on Friday. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at matson.com/Alaska.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. Ukrainians who fled the war in their country and sought refuge in America have been worrying whether they'd be allowed to stay in the country ever since Donald Trump was elected president. And Trump's comments last week about making a decision soon regarding the Ukrainians' legal status here has heightened their fears. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Svetlana Kravitz says the worst part is not knowing what the future will bring.
Because of the uncertainty, they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Kravitz is a first-generation Ukrainian-American whose family came to the United States in the 1990s and to Delta Junction about 25 years ago. She now works with Catholic Social Services, helping a new cohort of 200 Ukrainians find refuge in Delta and Fairbanks. She said nearly all of them want to start a new life here, but due to the uncertainty, they just try to cope one day at a time.
I mean, you can probably imagine you go to a different country, to a different place, and you work there and you live there, and you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So a lot of people are thinking, can we buy land and build? Can we buy a house? We can't. We don't know what's going to happen.
On Thursday, Trump heightened their anxiety when he said he's considering revoking authority granted by the Biden administration that allowed nearly a quarter of a million Ukrainians to stay in the United States.
And I'm looking at that, and there were some people that think that's appropriate and some people don't, and I'll be making a decision pretty soon. Okay?
The Reuters news agency, which reported Trump's comments, added that spokespersons for the White House and Department of Homeland Security said no decision has been made yet and that the agency had no new announcements. Kravitz said last week that worst-case scenario is what Ukrainian newcomers are dreading.
Trump might revoke the TPS or the UHP for them, and they'd have to go back.
Those acronyms refer to temporary protected status and Ukrainian humanitarian parole, which are two of the programs that authorize the newcomers to live in the United States. About 2,000 of them are in Alaska, and Catholic Social Services State Refugee Coordinator Issa Spatrizano says the organization serves 750 of them under the Ukrainian humanitarian parole program.
For individuals who are here that arrived at the Uniting for Ukraine, they're on humanitarian parole status. There is concern around them and their long-term ability to stay.
Spatrizano says all the newcomers share the uncertainty over their future.
Some of these Ukrainians have been in our state for the last 3 years, you know, and they've got jobs and they have community, and some of them were looking at going back to the university or looking at buying homes or other things. And so there's a real hesitancy to move forward with those sorts of laying down your roots if you're not sure what your future holds.
She says most of the newcomers are working and supporting their families, but there's concern that the Trump administration may revoke their authorization to work. And she says thinking about the war-torn country they'd be sent back to elevates that concern.
Ukraine is still a war zone. For many people, returning home would be returning home to nothing. Potentially the places where they lived have been bombed, destroyed, their school's gone, their home's gone.
Ukrainian newcomers in Delta declined to comment for this story, and Spatrizano says it's not surprising they don't want to say anything that might make things worse for them.
I think people can understand that feeling, and that's certainly a feeling that the Ukrainian community is having right now.
Kravitz says a couple of families that were living in Delta have returned to Ukraine, and so have an unknown number of young men who've gone back to help defend against Russian invaders. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Think of your fellow man, lend him a helping hand, put a little love in your heart. You see, it's getting late. Oh, please don't hesitate. Put a little love in your heart, and the world will be a better place.
Good morning, everybody out here in southeast Alaska, and a beautiful day it is. It's supposed to be, 38 today, and a little bit of drizzle, snow, could be rain, but it doesn't matter. It's still paradise. We only have about 8.5 minutes to go, so we'll play a couple by Kathy Mattea, 455 Rocket, and Standing Knee Deep in a River, Dying of Thirst. Take my time. She was made
straightaways. She grew up in Chevrolets. She's a rocket. She was made to burn.
I could count on one hand, with a leftover finger or two. I took them for granted, let them all slip away. Now where they are, I wish I knew. They roll by just like water, and I guess we never learn. Go through life parched and empty, standing knee deep in a river, and dying of thirst. Sometimes I remember sweethearts I've known. Some I've forgotten, I suppose. One or two still linger. Oh, and I wonder now why I ever let them go. They roll by just like water, and I guess we never learn. Go through life parched and empty, standing knee deep in a river, and dying of thirst. So the sidewalk is crowded, the city goes by, and I rush through another day, and a world full of strangers turn their eyes to me, but I just look the other way.